Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online, downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
My experience with all the companies I've owned, we have 107,000 people that went through our seminars in the 15-year period, plus all the tens of thousands of people I have worked with outside of those areas. So this is not based on some fantasy I have or something that I read in a book. This is based on actual experience. What you're going to find is the easiest thing to do is use investors. In the first 25 years I was in business, so I got owner financing, I got bank financing, so I got vendor financing. I did all sorts of things. But what happened was I didn't realize there was investor financing. The only reason I got into investor financing and got investors to invest our companies, about 25 years ago, we decided to go into Mexico. Well, nobody was going to finance anything in Mexico. Even today, they won't. So I had to go back to investors that we had and talk to them. And I didn't even realize that they would do something like this. So I just sort of lucked into this. And for the last 25 years, we have never gone to a bank other than for a line of credit. We don't ask for owner financing. We pay 100% cash on the deal, which means that the seller gives us a better price because it's an all cash price. We don't have to qualify. We don't have to get put up financial statements. We don't have to do anything. In fact, the average seller will tell you one thing. If you give me all cash, I don't care who you are or what you are. In fact, if you have a pet rock that you want to put in to manage it, that's fine, as long as you give me all cash. So what happens is, if you bring an investor in, as opposed to all the other types of financing, it's a lot easier way to go. The other thing is with an investor, most of them will ride with you for 4 or 5 years. In other words, if you show them what their share of the profit's going to be for 4 or 5 years, many of these investors do not ask you to pay them a return every month or every quarter, which means you have all the cash available in the business for a 4 or 5 year period to expand it. So it's really a fantastic way to go. But I want to tell you, for the first 25 years, it never dawned on me because I didn't know how to find investors.
Here's a question, Art, from Al Stopher of West Des Moines, Iowa. Given the value of a business includes the existing customer base, what advice would you give on working collaboratively with the existing owner to effectively transition those business relationships to the new owner? And there's quite a bit of information or propaganda on obtaining business funding from government sources. Are the government programs truly viable sources for startup and expansion capital, or is it just a bunch of hype?
First of all, when you're talking about working with customer lists or customers with the seller, we usually start working with the seller naturally before the close. The seller is normally also going to stay around for a month, 2 months, 3 months afterwards to help you with the transition. But again, we don't wait until the day we close. We start doing it ahead of time. Now, the seller is not going to allow you to do that too many days ahead of time because they don't want the word out too much before the close. The key thing is, in all years of doing this, I've never had any trouble with a seller transferring this over. Now, the other thing that happens is, a lot of times when we're buying a company, the seller is either staying to manage it or staying to run it, and the people in the area really do not know that there's been a change in ownership. Now, sometimes the people know, people that are supplying it, but a lot of times we're talking about a corporation, and the corporation name is ABC Corporation. The new corporation is still going to be ABC Corporation, so it's not something that in the 50 years I've been in business that we've ever had trouble with, but it's something to consider.
Do you work a clause into the contract, anything that keeps this smooth transition?
Well, it's not a smooth transition. If there's something that the seller does not bring up that causes you to lose that customer, or if the customer is in danger of leaving and you find out after you take over, there's always a paragraph in there that covers that. And the seller also realizes that they're going to have to give part of the money back if that's the case. See, the thing we have to keep in mind, I found this in the old years of teaching and being in business, most people have a lot of thoughts about the negative things of business. They have I used to ask people, make a list of 50 different things that are going to keep you from succeeding in business. And what happens is people write down all the things they've heard from their mother, their father, and all the scary stories out there. And I tell them to take the list of 50, put them in a drawer, safety deposit box, and then after you buy the business, take the list out. And all the years I was teaching, which 107,000 people, I told every one of them, if any one of you run into one of these things that come up that you wrote on that list, come back to me, because none of them exist. You've all held back, and you have not succeeded in business because of things that aren't true. And incidentally, the things that aren't true really relate to people that have trouble in business. The people that are successful in business don't go out and complain. So all you hear about is the feedback from the different people that have screwed up. So the other thing you had asked me about, you asked government financing. Well, you have SBA loans, Small Business Administration loans, which are guarantees, which come and go. But those are usually up to $1 million. We don't work on businesses that small, but I have assisted people over the years with this, and if you go that way, you're going to find that it's actually easier to go to a bank and get the bank to give you the loan than you go to the bank and try to get an SBA guarantee loan. In other words, if the business thing you're doing makes sense, the bank will actually lend you the money on the same terms as you could get a government financing. But there's a lot of people out there that sell a lot of seminars based on showing you all these great techniques that you have for getting government financing. You ought to just forget about it because it's just a waste of time.
You're saying business is under $1 million. It is possible to get government financing, but there's so much red tape, it's easier to do it through a bank?
Yeah, because what's going to happen is, let's say you get $1 million, the business itself should be enough security on that. But what happens is, they're going to ask you to put your house up, your collateral, your kids, and everything else. It's a very tough way to go. If you want to check, just go to the government and ask them for their sheets on what you have to fill out and how you have to perform to get that loan. But again, unless you're buying a large donut shop, it's not worth going after. Those are not good businesses. Because the problem is, it puts you in a category of businesses that are going to drive you nuts and turn your hair gray. Because I have always found, if you go after a business that net over $250,000 a year, and they're easier to finance than the smaller ones, you're going to find that the manager of your company doesn't call you and bug you all the time because he's going to be making enough money that he just considers you a hindrance.
Right, here's a question from Alan Watson. How do you find out that the person selling the business does not have a similar business in a different location, which allows them to doctor the books and stocks, et cetera, to make the business they are selling look better?
I have run into that a couple of times. I was thinking of one here in San Jose, California. There was a taxi company. The guy owned two taxi businesses. And I was only aware of one of them. First one in, there was one taxi company. And I noticed on one of them, there was no labor. And what he was doing was, he was pumping all the labor costs into the other business, which was showing a loss. And on the business that was showing a profit, which he was trying to sell, there was no labor cost. So what you have to do is you have to be very careful. Now the thing is, when you go in and check the books and go through all the due diligence that you normally go through with a good CPA or somebody else that's assisting you, you're going to find during that 30-day period, which is the normal due diligence period, all this stuff normally comes up. Also, you're going to find that you ask the seller a lot of questions. The seller has a tendency after a while to start confessing. If you don't ask anything, you won't get any extra information. But if you continue to check and do your due diligence, almost all of this stuff comes up.
Okay, so in the research phase, if you're doing your job, you should be able to determine these kind of things.
Yeah, all the ones that I've run into have come up in the first couple of days. In other words, but unless you're very naive, they're going to be very apparent to you when you start checking or talking, even when you start talking to the owner.
Here's a question from Albert Franklin in Modesto. Are there businesses that can be had for no money down?
Okay. First of all, when I was teaching classes, everybody accused me of teaching how to buy a business with nothing down. There's no such thing. Now, can you finance a business 100%? Yes. Can you get a business with nothing down? No. Because in all the years I've been doing this, I've never run into a seller that will let you in on I'm talking about not a dog, not a turnaround business, but a normal, good business. I haven't found any that will let you in with nothing down. It just doesn't exist. But if you find one that makes sense that it's large enough, you can finance it 100% or close to it, which is basically the same thing.
All right, here's a question from Mike. I have looked at buying a business many times. Many are selling a job, not a business, requiring financing that I currently do have.
What you have to realize when you're working with investors, say, as an example, the whole life changes, because when you go in and you try to get owner financing, say, as an example, the owner's going to qualify you, the owner's going to ask for extra collateral on these things, all sorts of things. They're also going to look at you a lot differently. Now, when you come in to buy a business, and you have an investor or investors, you're basically not asking for financing. You're paying all cash. So you don't have to go to a bank. You don't have to go through the seller. What you do is you have to talk to the investor. And all the investors, not all of them, but say 99% of the investors I work with are business owners. So they're not using ratios. They're not banker mentality. It boils down to one thing. If the thing that you're doing makes sense, and if you and the investor get along, you like each other, you're going to find you get the money. The most difficult thing is getting off your duck to go out to find a business, a good one, that makes sense. That's the most time-consuming and the most difficult thing.
Here's another question. There's a lot of talk out there that there's an average value of a business. Is it 2.3 times the net revenue for some or others, or is it just 1 year's annual revenue net? What is the formula, or is there one?
Okay, the one thing you have to worry about is when you get involved with people that want to use annual figures, because a lot of times they're trying to use annual sales, not nets. And don't ever get trapped into buying a business based on the amount of sales it has, because it could be doing $2 million a year and not make any money. Why would you want to buy something like that? What you have to do is you have to get it back to net profit or EBITDA, whatever you want to call it. I don't want to get involved in what that means, but what is the cash flow of the business? And what you're going to find is the multiples, the magic multiples that you have against net profit change. In other words, you'll find a business that's selling for, say, $300,000, a smaller one, and that one may be one or two times net. You get up over $1 million, you may find the same manufacturing business will go for 4 to 5 times net. So what you have to do is you have to get out there, figure the category you're going to go after, and then start doing your homework to find out what the market values are within that range, because it varies by size, it varies by type. It could be manufacturing, a distributorship, or a retail business. So there's all different multiples, and what you have to do is find out what they are for each category. But once you get out there and start looking at a few of them, it's going to become apparent to you what the going market rate is for that business.
Where can you find those values?
There are books that are put out by business brokerage associations. So if you know a business broker, you can ask them to look at their catalog, but those are mostly gross multipliers as opposed to net. What you do is you go out and find businesses that are for sale, and basically you use that as a guide. In other words, we just looked at 10 businesses for sale. We just experienced 5 businesses that have sold. You now are going to have a range of what they sell for, and you're going to find they're pretty much in the same category. Now, if you find other ones that are trying to sell for larger multiples, the thing you'll notice that they don't sell.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually the seller will get to the point where he adjusts the price down to what the market is. All the information is out there. It's not difficult to get. It's mainly going out and looking at categories, because a multiple in California for a certain type of business might be different than it is in Akron, Ohio. So find what it is for the area you're going into.
Dear Michael, hello again from Seoul, Korea. Here are my questions for Art. Here's 3 questions. Let's just take them one at a time. This is from Charles Jenkins. Number 1, how do you determine if there are unpaid bills and or not so good will in determining the fair purchase value of a business before making an offer?
When we go out to buy a business, there's usually 2 things you're going to find. Number 1, the seller is not going to divulge or let you get involved in a lot of the information that he has before you make an offer. So what we're normally doing, 99.9% of the time, we go in and offer a letter of intent. In other words, I, the buyer, offer to buy your business for $500,000 for the filing terms and conditions. This is a non-binding contract. I'm asking you to let me have 30 days to go through a due diligence period. At the end of that time, we'll sign a contract.
Do you give them any money down at all in the letter or two?
Okay, on the due diligence, the broker or the seller would love to get down payment money on a due diligence contract, but it's not done.
Is that what this is? A due diligence and a letter of intent is the same thing?
So the letter of intent covers a due diligence period. So what happened is we will put up a down payment when we get to the contract period, which is what we're doing in that area.
But you have 30 days to explore without...
On the average, it's 30. We have some that say the owner or the broker doesn't provide us with very much information. We get two sheets of paper on a large business. We might have to ask for 60 because we're going to have to put together information that should have been provided to us by the broker or the seller. So we're basically putting together a business plan. Hopefully, this broker or the seller will have put that together. But if we have to put it together, it will delay the close, but we usually are able to explain to the seller and or broker the reason for it.
Do you find that the business seller usually wants to hold back that stuff, and you're usually required to push them for more information in that research phase?
You know, the simple thing, if you stay away from turnarounds, dogs, and sleazy sellers, and you can, your gut level will tell you that, if you buy a good business making a good profit, the seller is very glad to tell you exactly what he's doing. He's going to be bragging about it. The only ones that hide it are the ones that they own a restaurant and they're going to talk to you about the skim they have, which never exists, and other type things. But as soon as you run into somebody like that, what you should do is walk away. The average person is going to give you all the information. Not getting the information is the exception. And for those of you that worry about that, get away from the worry. Go out and look at a couple of businesses as if you're going to buy them and see what happens. What you're going to find is the average seller is a nice person to work with. He's going to treat you very well because he or she who has the cash does the talking. So you're going to find they're very willing to do that. They're willing to give you all the information. Again, it's the exception that we're talking about right now. I don't run into it very often.
Okay. Here's another question from Charles Jenkins. How do you keep any valuable employees of the company you buy from leaving to join a competitor when they learn the business is being sold to someone they may not know?
Okay. What happens is when you're worried about employees leaving, we use management contracts, and your attorney can help you draw the thing up. Now, keep in mind, when you're doing this, be fair, because what you're trying to do is keep the employee, and you're also trying to keep from getting hurt, because what's going to happen is, if you have an agreement with your employee decides to leave or do something wrong, you're going to find the contract you have with him, when you go to court, is going to be looked upon by the court as protecting the employee, not you.
Mm-hmm.
So the employment contract or management contract, whatever you want to call it, is basically in favor of the employee, but it makes them feel good. But if you're going in, you may say, God, I have three or four key employees, I better make sure they stay. Well, I have done that in the past, but I have not done that recently because I've gotten to the point where I realize if I treat the employees well, they don't leave. I can't remember the last employee we had leave. I mean, at any level. We treat our people well. We give them above-average raises. They get above-average pay. We treat them very well. But, again, it's one of those things that you read about and people worry about that doesn't happen.
But let me ask you, I'm just confused. This management contract, are you suggesting if I'm looking at buying your business, Art, and you've got key employees, is this something that I get your employees to sign or you get them to sign? I don't understand how the management contract...
The buyer negotiates this with the employees of the seller.
The employees after the business is sold or before?
You're negotiating it before because if something comes up, you can't negotiate it afterwards because you can't tell how it's going to come out.
I see. So you would ask the owner of the business to talk to their employees about this?
Right, but only key employees. And, again, the sellers always worry about one thing. They worry about the fact that the word's going to get out. The employees are all going to leave. Your customers are going to drop you. So you have to be very careful doing this. So what you do is you set the thing up to talk to whoever the key employees are, who you think they are, and do it that way. Now, we've had some cases also where we have signed or put together the management contracts after we take over, but that's dangerous.
The owner of the business, before he sells it, would ask those key employees to sign this management contract?
No. What would happen is the owner would set up in a meeting between the buyer and the employees, and the buyer and employees then would negotiate whatever it is. It really has nothing to do with the seller.
Okay, you just got to feel it out.
Yep.
Okay. Here's another question. Hi, Michael. As I'm just putting up a business for sale site, this topic is of extreme interest to me. So two things. One, with all of the financial scandals involving corporations and accounting firms, how can a buyer protect themselves and get to the truth when examining prospective businesses?
This is a standard check that all CPAs go through. Because what happens is you get in there, before you even make an offer on a letter of intent, you've already usually have 3 or 4 years of profit loss, balance sheets, other information on the company. So you're doing that type work, and then after so many days or so many weeks, you sit down with the seller, and you draw up a letter of intent. In other words, it's a skeleton of the price I'm paying, what the terms are, how long the owner will stay, maybe 4 or 5 things. And also spelling out the fact that we're going to go through a due diligence period. I'm going to be looking at the business. I'm going to be going through it in detail. I'm going to be around. The seller may say, my God, it'll scare the employees. Fine. Tell them I'm an insurance investigator or something like that. But they have all sorts of things that they say. But what you have to do is you just do your homework. And if you don't know what the homework is, sometime you're going to have to bring in a CPA or an accountant, but usually a CPA. And usually you're doing it towards the end of the deal because you don't want to have that cost and have the deal fall apart. But once you bring the CPA in, they're going to be able to tell you what you should be looking for, and then they're going to tell you what they're looking for when they go through the book.
That question was from Don Broder. Okay, here's another question from Doug Graham. Hi, Michael. I'd like to ask Art, what is his best technique for finding profitable but undervalued businesses?
Okay. First of all, you have to get this undervalued out of your head, because you're going to find the return you get on the money you invest or the time you invest or the investors invest is going to be very good without going after underperforming businesses. Because if you do that, you're looking for dogs. And you're going to find, in going after a dog or a turnaround or underperforming, you're going to find that even if you solve that problem and you get your picture in the paper and they put you in Inc. magazine, I'll make you a bet on the next 3 or 4 that you work on, you go bankrupt and you dump every one of the companies that you had. It is less expensive and less worrisome and troublesome to go after good businesses. You don't want those.
Here's a question from Grant Siegel. Do you know of any good business brokers in the Midwest, specifically Indiana?
Talking about business brokers, I've been in this business for all these years, and I've worked with a lot of business brokers. The problem is trying to find a good business broker is almost an impossibility. I never in my life have ever recommended a business broker. And the reason for that is there's very few out there that are very good, and I do not want to get in the position of referring somebody and you get screwed on a deal and then you come back and sue me because I gave it as a reference. I have met so few out there that I consider legitimate or know what the hell they're doing that can't give that recommendation. But what happens is if you go out into the marketplace in Indiana and start to check on businesses that are for sale, you're going to find most of them are going to be listed, the better ones, with by brokers. And as you go out and look at a couple of them, it's suddenly going to dawn on you after a couple of weeks who you're getting along with, who's going to give you the most assistance, and who is doing the best job. One of the biggest problems you have with business brokers, they try to qualify you financially or experience-wise. And so what you have to do is you have to get in your head ways to get around that so they don't end up intimidating you. So,
can you give us an example of one or two ways to do that?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about that, and it suddenly dawned on me that when I go out to buy a business, there's two things that I have that's beneficial to me. Number one, I've been doing this for 50 years. I've owned many companies. So when I go out, nobody's going to challenge me, or nobody's going to say, well, God, what experience do you have? They know, or I can prove to them I have experience. And the next thing is the money. Well, I know I have access to the money. I either have the money or I have the access to the investment. I'm looking very positive. What you have to do when you go out there, if you don't have any experience at all, you better get a couple of people on your team that look good so that the broker and or seller is going to look favorably upon you. Now, if you're paying all cash on the deal when you buy it, the seller is not going to look at you at all, either as a broker. All they're going to do is look at you as a piece of meat. In other words, you're somebody that has X number of dollars to buy this business, all cash, and that's all they care about.
That makes sense. Here's a question from Glenn Lobo. I need to know how to value a business. I'm an osteopath and want to buy other practices. There is not much in the way of fixed assets, so it is goodwill, etc. I also want to buy these with as little of my own money as possible. How do I get the banks to work with that idea?
Okay, let me work in reverse. With medical practices, you can get financing through the bank. But also with medical practices, it is easier, probably the easiest type area to get investors in. Because a lot of the investors are in the business, they're in a health field, and they're interested in putting more of their money in other practices or other businesses in that area. When you go out to buy a business, if you want to look at it from a return standpoint, the average business, and I don't mean a little donut shop, but the larger businesses, I don't mean General Motors, I mean the ones sort of in the middle, usually have a return of 25 to 33% return on the money. Now, what does that mean? That means if you're buying a manufacturing company and the thing is priced at 4 or 5 times net, that means you're getting 20 to 25% return. When you get into service businesses, instead of paying 4 and 5, they're usually going for 3 times net. Now, keep in mind, it depends on the size of the business. So you're going to find the same manufacturing business or distribution company may sell for 1.5 to 2 to 3 times what a service business goes for. You're also going to find, on the low end, even with medical practices, that a lot of times they are being sold for 1 time the net. So what you're going to have to do is check the market in your area for the type of business you're looking for, and try not to use averages because you'll end up fooling yourself. Go out and check the market, see what's available, what's selling, what has sold. Use that as a guide, or you're going to overpay seriously.
Here's another question from Jason Seprick from Perth, Western Australia. Hi, Michael. I have a couple of questions for Art. Your original interview with him is one of the ones I've enjoyed the most on hardtofindseminars.com. Number one, do you believe in buying businesses which fit into a buying cycle of the consumer? Example, a business that fits well with baby boomers right now, or a biotech / vitamin business for the aging population?
Okay, now, I have people I work with that go out and go after businesses that way. They go out and take categories and take things that are hot today. Let's say I buy a business. The average business I buy nets between $1 million and $2 million a year and has for the last couple of years. When I go out there, I'm looking for manufacturing with a product. Now, sometimes we're getting into something where the product is hot and ready to go now, and other times it isn't. If you want to go out and target companies that are in those growth areas, that's fine also. It's just that it becomes a little more difficult, and you're going to have to widen your scope because you may be in Indiana, say, as an example, or Australia, and you may find that the business that fits what you're looking for is a long distance away. Now, keep in mind, if you go after a large enough company, and let's say it's making $500,000, $1 million a year net profit, you're going to find that your management is going to be paid X number, $100,000, say $150,000 a year. That manager is not going to bother you. So can you manage it from a distance? Yes. In fact, that's what I have done for the last 25 years. I have not worked hands-on in any company. And if you want to keep from getting gray and old before your time, consider not being a hands-on manager, because one of the best things that happens is you don't have people bugging you all the time because you're not hands-on. There's a manager there that takes care of the problems. And the other thing is, if you decide you want to own more than one business, very difficult when you're running one of them yourself. Once you pull away and don't run those businesses, you're going to find that you own multiple companies. You'll have less stress than the average guy with a little donut shop. My experience with all the companies I've owned, we have 100 and some thousand people that went through our seminars in the 15-year period, plus all the tens of thousands of people I have worked with outside of those areas. So this is not based on some fantasy I have or something that I read in a book. Is based on actual experience.
He has another question. I know you're not really in the seminar business anymore, but can anyone who purchases your course through Michael contact you for advice, clarification, or would you rather the material speak for itself?
The material is going to have to speak for itself, because I don't want to really get involved in that. And just take this other as an example. We have investors available that we can help people with, which we charge a fee for. But the thing we have to worry about, I've talked to Michael about this, we have a lot of people that just want to talk. And the problem is, although I have the time and I love working with people, and I do work with people that just want to talk, there's a lot of people out there that are time wasters. So I've talked to Michael about the fact that if somebody wants to come back to me and just rap and talk, they can do it $150 an hour. If they then decide to go ahead and buy a business and I help them with the financing, we'll refund all their money that they paid on the deal. But the key thing is, again, I found this out in a seminar business years ago. There are an awful lot of people out there that don't want to do anything, that just want to talk about it. And I'm getting too old for that.
That's fair. Here's another question from Jeremy Wood, Fruitport, Michigan. Hello, Michael. I'm excited to hear you are doing another interview with Art Hamill. I can't wait to hear it. I bought the course a few months ago, and I really like it. I'm ready to get rolling again with the buying of real estate and or a business. Question for Art. What do you do as far as a business plan goes for the business you're buying? Do you take the information on what the company currently is doing and then add what you intend to do? Will lenders of various sources want to know very much about me, the person buying the business?
Okay, as far as the business plan, if you're lucky enough to find a broker or a seller that has put together a business plan which you can use to buy the company or get financing, whatever, you're going to be very lucky, because a lot of times today they only put together two or three sheets of paper, and then if you need financing or you need an investor, you're going to have to put together a business plan, which is going to take you a couple of weeks or a few weeks. You either do it yourself or you're going to have to hire somebody for $5,000 or $10,000. If you want to do it yourself, there's a number of programs at your library. Just go to the business section in the library, and there's a number of programs. They'll have CDs, they'll have computer programs, everything that you can use to put together a business plan. But if you decide to go out and raise money and don't put together a business plan, the chance of you're getting the money is zero and none.
Here's a question from Matt from the United Kingdom. There's actually three questions. We'll knock them off one at a time. How do you find a good manager or director to run the business for you?
Okay. First of all, if you're starting a business from scratch, that's a very important thing. But if you buy an existing company that's been around 5, 10, 15 years and it's doing very well, most of them are managed. Now, there are some out there where the owner is still running the company. If the owner is still running the company and he's hands-on in there, what you're going to find is there will be other employees that you can move up. In other words, you can hire from within. You're also going to find that a majority of the companies are being managed by somebody other than the owner. I mean, if you go after something that's good, what you're looking for is you're looking for an owner that plays golf all the time and never shows up. You don't want to go after a business where the guy's there 80 hours a week. I mean, who wants to own that? And what will happen is you'll find usually within the company, somebody running it or whatever, you'll have the manager you're looking for. Now, can you go out into the marketplace during your due diligence period before you close escrow? Yes, you can. Can you find a manager? Yes. Are they easy to find? Yes. If you go out and buy a good business and you're willing to pay a good salary or a fair salary to somebody, trying to find somebody to run that company is not difficult at all. But keep in mind, this doesn't happen very often. I can't remember the last time we had to go out and hire a manager. I'm talking about in the last 20, 25 years.
Okay, great. Here's a question from Michael Morales. Michael Morales actually remembered you and went through your course in the mid-80s. And he asked, how should it, isn't that wild?
I feel old. Well, no, I go to national meetings that went through it before that. So that means when I tell people I'm only 37, they know I'm lying.
That's funny. Well, he remembers you, and he remembers your course and said it was great. But he's got a question. How should a buyer protect himself from overpaying for a business? Generally, a buyer will get seller carryback financing that is tied to the income and the profits that the seller promises. If the business is not as the seller says it is, then the seller loses out on getting paid all their money rather than the buyer losing out. Does that make sense?
You have to do your homework. You can put your arm, give the seller a big hug. You can look at the business, but take everything with a grain of salt. What you're going to have to do is check everything out that they give you. Verify it. On the numbers, you're going to have to bring a CPA in to check for 2 or 3 years or 4 years, whatever it happens to be. What you're doing is you're doing your homework. You're checking it out. Take your time. And what you're going to find is all these things will pop out. And once you go through your first business, even if you don't close on it, you're going to find by the time you get to the second one, the next week or the week after, the same things are going to pop up. And by the time you've gone out to look for maybe a month and you've looked at a number of businesses, the same thing will keep happening over and over again. And you'll find you can't believe how smart you get, how fast. But quit worrying. What you have to do is quit letting all these things bug you and go out and check the market. And with most of the things that you brought up today, Michael, these things really don't happen. But they're part of the 50 everybody always worries about.
Yeah, it's just fear.
Well, I know. I went through this in the beginning, too, but I didn't have anybody to talk to. I overcame the fear by screwing up, so.
You mentioned you want to get a CPA to check the numbers out. So you recommend if I'm analyzing several businesses, I should hire a CPA and say, look, I'm interested in buying some businesses and contract him to review the numbers for me.
Okay, no. You don't really have to do that. Once you start going through this, if you have an IQ of over 20, you're going to find you're going to start to see a pattern on the P&Ls and balance sheets, profit and loss and balance sheets. Now, if you need some help on description, that's okay bringing the person in. But what we try to recommend is don't bring the attorney and the CPA in until you've gone far into the due diligence period, because you may find that three or four of them fall apart and you end up with a large CPA and attorney bill.
So do it yourself.
Well, as much as possible. Keep in mind, what you're trying to do is keep your costs down. Because what will happen is you'll run up these large bills and you'll find a business that you don't really want. And you say, God, if I don't close on this, I'm in trouble. So you end up buying something you didn't want. Now, you're buying a good company. The average CPA and attorney will roll along with you. They'll say, okay, you're going to go through a four or five, a billion on a going basis, and then you can pay me after you get your business. So you don't have that expense as you're going along. But you also don't want to build up expenses because it may take you a while. And what you have to do is take on as much as possible checking out the business. In other words, learn how to do it. And again, just by going through three or four, you're going to find you will be amazed at how smart you get from business to business.
Right. So it's basically you need to do it yourself and learn how to do it yourself and do it right.
That's right. And when you take over the company, don't you want to know something about profit and loss statement and the balance sheet? I mean, are you going to be in big trouble?
The course that I sell goes over all that specifically on how to do that.
Well, that was the purpose of the course at the beginning. We had a lot of people coming to us because I was just basically a business owner and talking about all these problems. And I said, we need a program out there, which we put in the course, basically just to blow away all the crap you hear about businesses. And that's all the program has ever done. It blows the crap away and lets you see what is really there and then do it on your own. And again, after working with all the people I've worked with over the last 50 years, it's amazing to me that I haven't met anybody that, after a short while, doesn't comprehend almost all they're looking at when they look at a business. A business is not that complicated. And if you look at a couple of them, it's suddenly going to dawn on you, well, this is not very tough.
Well, speaking of the course, Neil Phillips from Cardiff, United Kingdom, got the course from me, and he has a specific question. He talks about when pricing a business in your manual in Section 5.22, you give a weighted value to the business based on net profit value. What figures would you use now, taking into consideration inflation? And he also asks, have you ever used these techniques to buy businesses in the U.K.? If not, do you know of anyone based in the U.K. that someone should look for advice?
Okay, first of all, that pricing was developed, what, 25, 30 years ago? Well, what we did at the time is to make sure that we did not have to have problems because of inflation, because of tax changes, or different situations in different countries. So that's how the thing was set up. We have not gone back to check it or do anything. I still use it as a guide. Everybody I work with still uses it as a guide. Everything that we taught in that course is the same today as it was when we first started many, many years ago. Now, I've had a lot of people come to our program from the UK. I've had a lot of people come from the Far East. In fact, we've had, toward the end, we had large numbers of people from the Far East that didn't even speak English. They were sitting in the front row with their translator or their interpreter. And the thing was fascinating because I always wanted to know how well I did. Every one of them went out and did fantastically well. And I was figuring, my God, if you can do it, you don't even, you really can't even understand the speaker. I mean, there must be something here.
Right.
What you have to do, quit thinking that things are different in other countries. Now, I can't speak for the UK. We have purchased businesses in France. We have purchased businesses in Italy and Germany. And I hate to say everything's the same, but even if you go to Mars, there's only certain ways that you do profit and loss statements, balance sheets, and other things. And the people are all the same. I mean, in the United States, we have a cross-section of people, and over the period of 5 years or 10 years or 20, I have worked with people from every nation on this planet that have been here less than a year. And I think I know England. In fact, I was just over there. I just got back from a cruise. and spending time in London a week or so ago. But the key thing is, if you get involved in the details of pricing and you want to get it down to the nuts, what you're going to find is you're never going to do anything. What you have to do is go out and go more broad stroke. In other words, in England, if we're buying a banking company and they're priced at 2x book value or whatever it happens to be, the net is the value in the area. If you're going through the detail that he's going through on this, all he's going to do is waste his time. In other words, this is a great study for an engineer or a mathematician, but that isn't the purpose of the program. The purpose of the program is to go out and buy a business.
I hope you're enjoying this interview with Arthur Hamill. Please continue to part two.
I started in the business buying and reselling hard-to-find seminars material. I had specialized in locating the very most expensive material, which was by a marketer named Jay Abraham. Well, I purchased from the original owners the original seminar material in the form of audio tapes, video tapes, books, and courses, and I resell them to people like you for pennies on the dollar. So someone may have paid $20,000 to attend a seminar and sit 5 days in an uncomfortable chair, but they all come home with the audio tapes. Well, I, from a personal need, didn't have the money, and I located hundreds of people who had these seminars, and I buy them and resell them to you. So what that means for you is you could get a $20,000 seminar for 10 to 20 cents on the dollar from me. If you go to hardtofindseminars.com, go to the product page and look for the section J. Abraham, and you'll see a multitude of seminars that I have available waiting for you. So if you want to take advantage and learn from the very best marketer in the world, Jay Abraham, and if you want to do it for a lot less money, head on over to hardtofindseminars.com, and I'm sure I'll have something that will fit your budget.